Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, January the 18th, day number 167 of 2015. Tonight we're going to be joined by our good friend Barry Jacobson. Barry, of course, a military historian, military blogger. We have Barry on the program quite often to talk about national security issues and national security concerns for the country. Once in a while, we visit with Barry also on military history, and tonight we're going to be taking a look back at one of the greatest battles in world history, the Battle of Waterloo, which happens to have happened 200 years ago this week. So we'll be listening to what Barry has to say. He's written extensively about the Battle of Waterloo. He has published several articles over at his website. In fact, I have a link to the latest one that he wrote. I have a link to it on the show information. If you click on that, it'll take you to that article, and you'll get a lot of background information about the Battle of Waterloo. We're also going to be joined later on by a couple of friends who are going to be calling in with their thoughts and their comments about the battle. So we've got a full program for you tonight as we look at the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to tell you about our good friends over at audible.com. You know, if you're the kind of person who enjoys listening to books, and many people do that now, they listen to books because they have a lot of things going on. Sometimes they don't have time to read or whatever it may be. Well, they're using audible.com as their source for audiobooks, and we have a link to it on the show information. You click on that, it'll take you to their website, and I think you're going to see two things. Number one, they have tremendous inventory of audiobooks. And number two, you're going to check out that they have a lot of prices, a lot of specials, and a lot of promotions. They have a lot of sales, and they have a lot of promotions. So if you're the kind of person who enjoys a good sale, a good promotion, you check out my friends at audible.com. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back in a second with Barry right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let's say hello to our good friend, our military historian, our good friend, military blogger, Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am very well. How are you, Silvio?
Absolutely great. How is everything in San Diego these days?
Well, our weather is terrible, or at least terribly boring. It's always sunny and beautiful. Right now it's about 75 degrees. So, not clouds in the sky. It's not very interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of boring and beautiful. that's what they say. That's what they say. I don't know
it's
that
like
anybody.
It's like being married to the most beautiful and sexiest woman in the world, but after 10 or 15 years, And she's still just the sexiest, most beautiful woman in the world. And, you know, it's nothing new. It's the same thing.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a wonderful same thing, but it's still the same thing.
Yes, that's right. It's always the same thing, but as you say, it's a wonderful, wonderful same thing. Well, tonight, I was saying in the introduction that you and I have done a lot of shows about history over time. We did a series of shows about World War One. We've done shows about battles. And tonight we have one that really stands out in world history. I've been reading some of your material. This one really stands out, and I thought maybe we could look at some of the major points about the Battle of Waterloo, and then later in the program, in the second segment, we'll be joined by our friends Michael and Rosine, who are going to call in some comments and some questions. But I thought we'd look at a few things tonight, Barry, like why is this battle important? Number two, who were some of the major characters, some of the major players of this battle? And then, of course, the major consequences that came out of this battle. Every battle obviously has consequences, good and bad. And then if we have time, I'll ask you for a little explanation of some of the weapons or some of the military strategy of that particular battle. So I thought we'd look at these things tonight. But before we do, tell the audience a little bit about what you've written. I mean, I'm really impressed with the amount of stuff you've written about the Battle of Waterloo. So just take a minute and talk about that.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I've been reading and studying Waterloo since I was very, very young. I think my first experience was with Life magazine's issue where they went deep into the Battle of Waterloo. And like many young men, I was fascinated with the colorful uniforms of the Napoleonic era and the, you know, the larger-than-life characters like Napoleon himself, you know, Wellington and some of the other characters. So I've been studying all my life. And then you know, years ago, I started a blog, military history blog, called Deadliest Blogger. And I started off just several years ago on the anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, which is June 18th. I started writing what I thought was going to be a simple blog post on Waterloo. But as I wrote it, it, like many things, it took on a life of its own. But by the time I'd gone into sufficient, I felt sufficient detail. I hadn't even got to the battle yet, and I already had filled up, you know, so 1,500 words. So I decided I'd make it two parts, and two parts go into three, and three into four. And by the time I was done, it was, you know, a 17-part series.
Now, just for the benefit of many who may not know where Waterloo is, Waterloo was a region, a city, a place. Just give us a little explanation of you know, why it's called the Battle of Waterloo.
Well, it's called the Battle of Waterloo by the English. Each of the participants called it something different. It's a village. Waterloo itself is a village, not very far to the south and to the east of Brussels, which in fact was the ultimate goal of Napoleon's thrust into Belgium, was to capture Brussels. So it's not very far from Brussels, and in those days it straddled the main road from a crossing of the Sambre River, which was the boundary between France and Belgium. There was a north-south road going from France to Brussels, and Napoleon marched up that road. And so Wellington stopped him at Waterloo before he could get to Brussels. But as I said, the English called it Waterloo, though the battle really was fought a little bit south of that at a place called, a village called Mount Saint Jean, or Saint Jean. English is spelled Jean, but French pronounces Jean. And that's what Napoleon called it, the Battle of Mount Saint Jean. And yet the Prussians, who were attacking Napoleon's right flank from the east, they were the third participant in this three-way battle. The Prussians called it the Battle of La Belle Alliance, which was where Napoleon had his headquarters during the battle. So somewhere between La Belle Alliance in the south and Waterloo in the north is the battlefield.
Right. I had never understood, and again, you learn something every day, but I had never understood why a place in Belgium would be called Waterloo. But, you know, I guess that was the English called it Waterloo. I thought Waterloo was was what everybody called it. But and by the
no,
way,
Waterloo is in fact a village. It's just one of many villages in that you know, what was the battle space that day, and Wellington just happened to call it that, and that's what the English ended up calling it.
No, but I guess what I'm curious about is the word Waterloo sounds like an English word, Waterloo. It doesn't sound like French. So was it just an aberration that this was an English word, or maybe it been?
The problem is, and not to get into a linguistic discussion, but you know, English has a lot of French words incorporated into it. You know, dating back to the Norman Conquest, when the French Normans, you know, conquered England. So you know, the fact that some French words sound English shouldn't be too surprising.
Interesting. By the way, you said that Jean is pronounced John, or it's written like Jean, J-E-A-N, and pronounced
exactly.
John. That is one of the things that I learned about when I referred to a man as Jean, and he said, "No, it's John." So I think all of us all of us have learned that that lesson in French in our lives. Well, I mentioned I want to talk about some major themes about this battle tonight, Barry, and let's begin. I thought maybe we'd begin with the characters, the people who became famous or were already famous because of the battle. So why don't we start with them? Who were some of the major characters of this battle?
Well, I guess you can't really start unless you start with Napoleon himself, Napoleon Bonaparte. You know, the man bestrides that era of history like a colossus, you know, bestriding the harbor of Rhodes. He rises as a nobody. He comes from Corsica, comes to France during the time of the monarchy in the late 18th century, goes to the military academy and graduates as an artillery officer, and, you know, gets commissioned about the time of the revolution. And the monarchy is swept away, and a republic takes its place. And so there's tremendous opportunity for somebody of ability and vision and endless ambition to grow a career and build their career. And Napoleon does that. He takes advantage of every opportunity brilliantly. Napoleon was a genius. He was a military genius, but he was also a political genius. The man was one of these fellows that if he had been, you know, inclined to music, he would have been a Mozart, but he was inclined towards war, boundless energy in his youth. And he used it to advance himself, partially through marriage to a well-placed woman, Josephine. But he advanced himself to the rank of general, first in the Republic, made his bones, as they would say in the Mafia, at the Siege of Toulon, where he helped the French to drive off the English, who were besieging the place. This is in southern France. Because England was at war with the new revolutionary government of France, as was Austria and Prussia and some other European countries in Spain, who didn't like the fact the French were whopping off the heads of their king and queen. And the monarchs take exception to that, since many of theirs are cousins. So France was besieged by enemies, and Napoleon defeated them one after another until eventually became the leading political figure in France, and ultimately had himself crowned emperor of France. And does that around 1804.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Interesting note about Napoleon. He was physically a very small man, wasn't he? Not very tall. I think maybe, 5'3", 5'4"?
Yeah, I should know this. I don't know exact height, but yeah, that's about right. He was shorter than the average. He certainly wasn't a dwarf, but he was, you know, shorter than the average man at the time by a few inches anyway. But I don't think those who ever encountered him thought of him as a shorty. You know, quite the opposite. He was one of these larger-than-life characters. I mean, he was known to walk right up to one of his grenadiers. The grenadiers were the tallest men in the army. You know, they're the shock troops of any regiment. He'd walk up to one of those grenadiers and he'd pinch the man's earlobe, and he knew all the soldiers by name, and they just adored him. They worshipped him. So Napoleon, by the time of Waterloo, Napoleon has basically conquered all of Europe and then lost it over about a 10-year span, from about 1805 until 1814. He merely conquered all of Europe from Spain to Russia, and even a campaign in Egypt. And finally, he was defeated by a coalition of enemies led by England, Austria, Russia, including Sweden and Prussia. they defeated him, and he went into exile in a place called Elba, which is an island off of Corsica in the Mediterranean, in the Sea of in the Tyrrhenian Sea. And after only 1 year, he heard, as he said, the pleas of the French people to come back. They were very unhappy under the newly restored Bourbon monarchy. And he came back out of exile, and his soldiers flocked to him. And by February, this is February 1815, he leaves Elba, and by March, he's back in Paris. And that triggers what's called the 100 days from then until his eventual second abdication. He rules as the emperor again, and no one wants to make peace with him. All the European powers immediately declare war, and their armies are already poised all around France to attack. It's only been a year or so since they won the war against him to begin with. And after his overtures are refused, he raises an army. He finds France only with about 46,000 soldiers, but he raises nearly 200,000 within a couple of months. And it's really a superb army. It's all his old veterans, who many of which have been in prison for years during his wars, captured during various battles. And now they've been released as part of the armistice, and they're eager to get back into the fight. And France had really done well during that rest period since his abdication, so he was able to field the best army he had fielded since nearly the beginning of his wars. And with this army now of about 130,000, he marches north to strike the nearest of the enemy forces, which was in Belgium, and that was the Anglo-Dutch under Wellington, a British general. And his partner, who was camped to his east, the Prussian army under Marshal Blücher. And we can talk about those two just next.
Yeah. Now, another quick question about Napoleon. There's something called the Napoleon complex, which is when a very small man. I know that you've heard that, right? I know that in Spanish they use that. They use that a lot, and it's when when a man is small physically, and he becomes a little aggressive, they say he's got a Napoleon complex. So Napoleon not only influenced military and world history, I guess he also had an influence on psychiatry. I guess.
He's lent, of course, as the battle warlord, who lent itself to a couple of songs, as you point out earlier today, one by Bee Gees,
right.
One by ABBA.
That's right.
And there's a term in English language, which is you've met your Waterloo, which basically means you've met your final defeat, because that's what Waterloo became for Napoleon.
Right, and in fact, the song by ABBA, Waterloo, is the song that made them famous. So that song, the one by the Bee Gees.
It's a catchy little ditty.
Very catchy. I remember it when it came out. Which kind of dates us a little bit. But I remember when it came out, and it became their first American hit called Waterloo.
Let me just interject here for a second. ABBA was wonderfully popular in Europe, and they were, I think, a Swedish band.
That's right.
But they never caught on in the United States to the same extent that, say, the Beatles did, or some of the other European groups that came over.
I think that, as I recall, ABBA, and they had a few hits here, but you're right, they were more popular in Europe. But as I recall, ABBA, they were four people, and each letter identified each of the members, A, B, A, B. And the two girls were the two A's. And I have to confess that I spent a lot of the 70s thinking more of the two A's than the two B's, because they had two of the most beautiful girls from Sweden who ever came out of that country. But we'll leave that for some other night. Let's get back to the Battle of Waterloo. But yes,
let's talk about two men who were not beautiful.
That's it.
And that's the Duke of Wellington and Marshal Blücher.
You got it. Let's go for that.
All right, we'll start with Wellington. Wellington is the most celebrated of all Napoleon's adversaries, and really, aside from Napoleon himself, he was probably the only military man of military near genius, or at least excellence. His name is Arthur Wellesley, and he was Anglo-Irish nobleman. A gentleman to his very boots, in the old sense of a gentleman, being a landed aristocrat. And he always held that against Napoleon. Napoleon was a commoner. He once famously said that Napoleon's presence on the battlefield was worth 60,000 troops, but he's no gentleman, and as though that dismissed the rest. But he originally started in India, the British Army, and made a career there, a very successful career and a reputation. And then came to take over the British forces fighting Napoleon in Spain, what was called the Peninsular War. Now, he never engaged Napoleon himself. He never even met Napoleon in battle until Waterloo, Waterloo. He defeated every marshal, though. Marshals were the corps commanders of Napoleon's army. He defeated every corps commander, every marshal that Napoleon sent against him in Spain. And eventually drove the French completely out of the peninsula and invaded France from the south during the 1814 campaign that led to Napoleon's first abdication. By the time Waterloo comes along, by the time June of 1815 rolls around, he is in command of an army of very mixed quality, Dutch and English. The Dutch were now allies of the English. And when I say Dutch, that includes Belgium. Belgium and Holland were one kingdom. And they're on the battlefield is the crown prince of that kingdom, which is Prince William, William of Orange, Slender Billy, the British called him disparagingly. And he's a man of great ambition and very little ability. But Wellington is a great general, and he's got an indifferent army. And so he's a second character. And by the way, he was called by his troops Nosy because he had a very large hooked nose. Christopher Plummer played him in the movie, I thought, brilliantly, if you ever saw the movie Waterloo. So that's Wellington, and he commands the Anglo-Dutch, and he's expecting Napoleon to invade Belgium by way of Mons, which is somewhat to the west of Waterloo, because a thrust there would potentially cut off his retreat line back to the coast, where you have to retreat to his ships and go back to England if he was defeated. So he's very sensitive to that, and Napoleon played on that by making feints towards Mons before he crossed the border further east at a place called Charleroi. And Wellington famously said when he heard on the morning of June 15th that Napoleon had crossed the frontier at Charleroi, much, much further east than he was deployed and ready to fight. And in fact, was now on the road to Brussels, which was virtually undefended because of this feint that Napoleon had pulled off. Wellington famously said, "The man has humbugged me." Meaning he's cheated me.
I've heard that phrase before, humbug. Wasn't that the Christmas Carol?
That's right. That was one of Ebenezer Scrooge's famous saying.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So Charles Dickens had an influence on the battle, or the battle had an influence on Charles Dickens, because I think the novel was written after the battle, so it probably worked the other way. So
the third character is Marshal Blücher. He commands the Prussians, Gebhard Blücher, and he's an old man, a very old, tough German soldier. And two things really can be said about Blücher that encapsulates everything you need to know about him. The first is he was incredibly stubborn and tenacious, like a dog. Think of a pit bull. Once a pit bull bites down, it doesn't let go. He was an old cavalry officer of the Prussian army, and he was very tenacious. And during this campaign, which lasts 3 days, his army is defeated. We'll talk about it in just a minute. But his army is defeated by Napoleon at a very bloody engagement on the 16th at a place called Ligny. And a lesser man would have retreated. In fact, he was advised by his chief of staff, von Gneisenau, to retreat back to Prussia and regroup, protect the road to Berlin. Napoleon had conquered Berlin years before, and in fact conquered all of Europe, and the Prussians had been defeated by Napoleon before. And they're very sensitive that if they were defeated entirely and annihilated, they would. So Gneisenau, his chief of staff, warned Blücher that we should retreat. And instead, Blücher had promised Wellington he would defend him and meet him at Waterloo. And he told his soldiers, "I have promised my brother Wellington I will meet him at Waterloo. Don't let me down." And of course, they didn't. The Prussians regrouped beautifully. and we'll get to that a little bit later, but they were the major force in the battle, as it turned out.
Yeah. So those
the second
were
thing
the...
you need to know about Blücher, well, let me
yeah,
do the last
ahead.
Thing. The
go
second
ahead.
Thing you need to
yeah,
know about Blücher is Blücher hated Napoleon with a great passion. Apparently, and it's something you'll understand as a Latin male, Napoleon had apparently played court to the Prussian queen when he captured Berlin. I'm not sure, and no one probably is sure exactly what it was exactly that pissed off Blücher and most of the Prussian aristocracy. But Queen Maria Louise of Prussia was a beautiful woman. And even the portraits, which, you know, you see portraits of that period, women are seldom attractive by modern standards, but this woman really was. She was candy box pretty. And Napoleon paid court to her and maybe tried to seduce her. She was a very virtuous woman, and she didn't fall for it, but just the attempt alone incensed Blücher so entirely that he was out to hang Napoleon. After the battle, he pushed to have Napoleon hung, and it was only Wellington that stopped him.
So I guess jealousy always does play a role in these things, right?
It does.
You know, you can't take jealousy out of it. I tell you what we're going to do, Barry. We have a very nice lady who's going to be joining us with a question in a minute, and then later Michael, and then we're also going to talk about some of the other things that I want to hear from you tonight, is that, you know, why this battle is important and some of the major consequences of the battle. But I don't want to keep this lady waiting on the phone. And I'm sure she's got a wonderful comment. Plus, you're going to love her French accent, Barry. I'm just telling you that she has a beautiful French accent. So we'll hear the French perspective of all of this from this lady, Rosine. We're going to take a little break. We've got some sponsors that I want you to hear from. And then when we come back, we'll be talking to Rosine and we'll continue our conversation with Barry. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're doing a chat with our good friend Barry Jacobson about the Battle of Waterloo. And we just discussed some of the characters, and right now I want to say hello to our friend Rosine, who I was joking about her wonderful French accent, but I'm sure she's got a French perspective on this
hello,
war.
Steve.
I think she's – how are you, Rosine? Please say hello to Barry.
Good, and you? Good, and you? How are you doing? Hello, Barry. How are you doing?
I am doing well, and it's a pleasure speaking
good.
With you, my dear.
Good. I'm very impressed by all your knowledge about Napoleon, and because you know more than most of the French people know about. So, well, I have a little question. You know, Napoleon was, as you said, a genius. That's true, but he was. He arrived where he arrived because of his military strategy. He was really an outstanding military strategy. But do you notice, what do you think about the fact that he got the power with the military? He was very, the brain, very politically oriented, and he had good thoughts. Okay, fine. He conquered Europe. But what do you think he had this idea to become a nobility? Why didn't he did not stay like the leader of the military, the leader of the country, a new leader? Why did he have the need to make himself an emperor, to add a title of nobility to his power?
Okay, I'm having a little trouble with your accent, but I think you're asking why did he adopt the title of emperor?
Yeah, why did he did he try to add the title of emperor. He was already very well known. He could have led the country with his military strength, with his brain. Why did he need to have this nobility to make himself an emperor? And let me tell you, he gave title to all his brothers, sisters, cousins. They all have titles that he gave them. Now, the French nobility coming from the king did not like that at all. It's a matter of fact. Most of them does not count the family of Napoleon as a real blue blood.
Were you able to
understand?
Did you get it, Barry? Because I'd be happy to.
I did.
Yeah, good.
Go ahead, Silvio, and I would say if we're comparing notes, so I think I got her. So.
No, I think what you're asking is, you know, here's a man who had power, but yet he wanted to have nobility. He wanted to have titles. He became emperor. He gave titles, as Rosine was saying, to his family members, something the French monarchy didn't care for. He had a desire for titles.
Let me address that. I think I get it. Napoleon took the title of emperor originally after being first consul of France, which was his earlier title during the Directory. A Directory being the government of France post Reign of Terror. He took the title of emperor possibly for two reasons. One is because he was, I think, at some level trying to recreate the empire of Charlemagne. If you think of the conquest of Napoleon, they are the territories that were once controlled by the Frankish Empire of Charlemagne. So that may have been part of his motivation. Keep in mind also that Napoleon was the ultimate opportunist, and his conquest really followed a pattern of whatever opportunity was available. For example, invasion of Spain didn't make a lot of military or political sense. But it was an opportunity. You know, the Bourbon monarchy of Spain was weak, and he wanted to put his brother on the throne of Spain to shore it up and ensure his loyalty, as well as gain his fleet. But he was an opportunist. But I think one reason was he adopted the title of emperor for that reason. And the second reason was because it gave him a little more prestige among the other monarchies of Europe.
That's right.
Diplomatically. Go ahead, my dear.
Yeah, I said an emperor is more prestigious than a king.
That's right. More prestigious than certainly a first consul.
Yes.
Which is the title he had before that. And you mentioned his marshals. He took his marshals, and there were many of those, and he made them princes of the empire.
Yes.
With titles of Duke of this and Prince of that, but there's a real difference between a prince of the First Empire and that of the ancient regime, of the Bourbons.
Yeah, that is a difference.
For one thing, the old regime, the titles of the nobility pertained to regions of France in which they had some power, some authority over. Whereas Napoleon's marshals had no authority over any Frenchmen. Their titles were all titles of areas that France had conquered during Napoleon's wars, including, for instance, Marshal Massena was the Duke of Dalmatia, which is in modern-day Croatia. And Ney was Marshal of Moscow, Duke of Moscow, which is because he fought in the Russian campaign. So these were titles that were not did not upset the French. As the earlier titles that the old nobility had. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Because there is a lot of titles that he gave to his family that did upset the French, at least the French from the royal family. That's what it is. But if you notice this desire to become an emperor and to be above the king of France, to be better, to do better. That's the one thing that you never saw in this country. I noticed that in this country, none of the powerful people ever tried to get a title of nobility. I remember, do you know Ann Coulter? Ann Coulter, one day she was speaking and she said, "We in America, we are a country where we don't have any title. We have no nobility, and we will never have any nobility." What do you think about that?
You meant Ann Coulter, yeah. You meant Ann Coulter, yeah. Right. Were you able to get that, Barry? Did I lose Barry? I think the question was that Ann Coulter said that in America there were no titles, something that, you know, I've heard myself, I've heard from other people as well. So I think the question from Rosine to you was, what do you think of that, that in America there are no titles? Nobility titles, I guess.
Well, and in fact, in France of the Revolution was trying to be the same. It if you remember, the three phrases of the French Revolution were liberty, equality, fraternity.
Uh-huh.
Égalité is the most important. It's that we're all equal. All Frenchmen are equal. And when I say Frenchmen, of course, I mean French women as well. So liberté, égalité, fraternité, and Napoleon didn't completely violate that, because again, even though they made these marshals who were made them princes, they didn't lord it over other Frenchmen. And in fact, he himself created a Senate, much like the Roman Senate, which comprised the various classes of France.
Mm-hmm.
And they, at least by 1815, had the right to vote him out of office. One of the reasons he had to fight the Battle of Waterloo, rather than retreat when the situation didn't look very good on June 18th, was because he would lose so much prestige if he allowed the Allies to invade France a second time, as they had in 1814, mm-hmm. that he would have been impeached by the French Senate and probably have lost his position as the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
So he really was dependent upon winning. And, you know, he was both a politician and a general at this point. And at Waterloo, the politician had to make the decision to overrule the general, because the proper military response by midday at the Battle of Waterloo would have been to withdraw. He had thrown the dice. He had come up snake eyes, and he needed to withdraw while he still had an army, and he didn't. He fought on, hoping to you know, get better luck, and it failed him, as we can talk about later.
Yeah, Rosine, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well,
as always, your perspective is wonderful, and I want to thank you.
Thanks, Barry. It was a very good information. Very well done.
Yeah. Barry's wonderful, and
thank you very much.
You may want to. I don't know whether you heard this in the introduction or not, but there's a link to the article that Barry wrote about this battle. It's in the show information.
Oh, yeah. I did not hear that.
And I also put it on Facebook, so you can check it over there. But thank you so much, Rosine. It's a great honor to have
you.
Thank you so much. Let's move on right now, Barry, to another person who's calling in, and that's Michael, and he has a question for you as well. So, Michael, go ahead.
Hello, Barry. Hello, Silvio.
Thank you.
Hi, Michael.
Thank
How
you.
Are you?
My question, actually, I have a couple of questions. The first question has to do with the influence of guns and the role that they play in the benefit of the Allied armies. I'm talking about the rifles, you know, versus the muskets. The soldiers of the Principality of Nassau, the German Principality of Nassau, they had rifles that basically were invented during that era, the era preceding the Battle of Waterloo, and that pretty much were responsible for holding down the French when they were trying to overtake their position, which was the farm of Hougoumont.
Le Hastan, La Hastan.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the farm, yes.
And I don't know if you can comment on that. And also, my other question has to do with Napoleon's a strange decision of basically taking off from the field early on after the battle has started around 11 in the morning and going back to the inn in which you know, he had his headquarters, which was about three quarters of a mile from the front itself. Was he being overconfident, believing that he really had won the battle, or what do you think was the reason behind that very strange decision?
Okay. You say you had a third question, or is that just those two?
Those two for now.
Okay, well, let's talk about the first one, the second one first, why he took a position so far in the rear. Napoleon's position at Waterloo was, if you think of it in terms of north-south geography, he was facing north. His battle line straddled the north-south road, which was centered on La Belle Alliance, which is named the village he was headquartered at. And he was on one side of a valley, and on the other side of this channel valley was the British and Anglo-Dutch army straddling a ridge line. And their position was centered on Mont-Saint-Jean or Mont-Saint-Jean. So both armies, one army is facing south, the British are facing south, Anglo-Dutch, and then on the north, that's in the north, and then south of that is Napoleon's army facing them. But the Prussians from the east came in fairly early in the battle. They came in dribs and drabs, starting with one corps after another, arriving through a very difficult terrain, through a woods on Napoleon's right flank. And it began to put pressure on his right flank at a place called Place Noir. And he had to keep filtering troops. And in fact, he had turned an entire corps, low battles corps, to face them for the entire battle. So his battle line became basically an L-shaped battle line with his right wing facing an axis facing east, drawn up on a north-south axis facing east. So if you think of his battle is actually fighting two battles. He's fighting a battle to the north, trying to push the British off their ridgeline and break their line. And then he's fighting a defensive battle on his right flank facing to the east at a place called Place Noir, where the Prussians are coming. So his position at La Belle Alliance allowed him to direct both battles, or both parts of the battle, from a central position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the answer to the first question. Plus, not to mention the fact that he was staying out of artillery range, the battlefield is not that large. And when we finally released the old guard to try to break the middle guard to break the British line towards the end of the day, he rode forward only to the point where he was within the artillery range, and then he backed off because artillery was so good in those days that, you know, if you got too close, he could get hit. And in fact, British gunners early in the battle, the very beginning of the battle, told the Duke of Wellington they could hit him. They could see him reviewing his troops before the battle, and they could take a shot at him and try to kill him. And Wellington said, generals have better things to do than try to kill each other in the middle of the battle. And he refused to allow them to do it. So that's the answer to your first question. The second question revolves on rifles and their effectiveness. The rifle you're referring to, which was in the hands of the Jaeger or Hunter regiments of the various Allied contingents, both the Prussian and Anglo-Dutch, all the Germanic forces, and in British Army there were actually rifle regiments present, like the I think it's the 93rd or 95th is a rifle regiment, and the 60th another rifle regiment. These guys had a rifle called the Baker rifle, and it was not a smoothbore like everyone else had. All armies basically had muskets with small units of riflemen. I'd say small units, I mean nothing larger than a regiment, and mostly in battalion strength. But the majority of weapons were muskets, which were smoothbore, and they were fired en masse, and they had a range of about 100 yards effective, and really, you know, as low as 50 yards effective in some cases, depending on the age of the musket, because they wear out over time and lose effectiveness. But the rifle, the bigger rifle, was much more accurate. The problem with it is it was much slower to fire. And so it was not adopted generally throughout Europe for quite some time until about the 18th, almost the American Civil War is when rifles became kind of common throughout, you know, armies, rifled muskets they were calling them by that point. So how effective were they at Waterloo? Well, in defense of La Haussan, or in English, Les Saints, which was in the very center of the battle, it's a farmhouse that's bestrides the road, or it's to, just to the side of the road, the main road. And the sand pit beside it, which was occupied by British riflemen throughout the battle, those rifles were very effective at keeping French skirmishers at bay. And that's really their best at, keeping the French skirmishers, which were supposed to advance and pin down the heavy units, had pinned down the line formations or the squares of musket-armed infantry, and wear them down before the French columns of main infantry formations came up with bayonet to try to break them. So that was French tactics. You know, swarm forward with all these voltigeurs, which are, I mean, it's Volter in French, and you try to wear them down with musket, or the right, yeah, musket fire, in a dispersed skirmisher formation. And then behind those come these massive columns of the French battalions with bayonets, and they then assault and break through the formation. And that didn't work against the English, because and their German allies, including the Nassau and Dutch formations, because they had these Baker rifles, and they were very good at keeping the French skirmishers at bay.
Oh. Yeah. I tell you something, Barry. I just have to say, your knowledge of this is absolutely impressive, isn't it, Michael? I mean, it's just absolutely. I mean, I'm sitting here saying, my gosh, Barry, you should teach a college course on the Battle of Waterloo. It's just amazing how much you know and how much detail. You know, Michael, we're going to have to run, though. Do you have a quick question? Because we're going to have to run. I got to get to a break.
Yes, I have a quick question. It has to do with the role of, you know, of the Allied troops in the battle, because, the British take the victory as theirs, and they say, well, you know what, the Dutch and Belgian regiments, they ran away, they, you know, broke out when they faced the British. But the reality, in my opinion, is it was thanks to, you know, Blücher and the Prussians that the day was saved. So I would like to know your opinion on that.
I'll tell you what, Sylvia, if we have to take a break, if we
yeah, why don't we do that?
That in the second half.
Yeah, let's do that. We're going to take we're going to take a little break, Michael. Hang in with us. And after the break, we can answer Michael's question, but also the larger question of the evening, of course, what was the significance of this battle, and, you know, what was its significance in world history? So we're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from some sponsors. By the way, you cannot hear the sponsors tonight. They will be in the podcast. So if you're wondering what happened to the sponsors, they will be in the podcast. But anyway, they are part of the program, and I'm grateful to Blog Talk Radio for allowing our program to include some of their national sponsors. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with Michael and Barry right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're talking tonight with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We've had Barry on the show many, many times to talk about national security, and tonight we're talking about the Battle of Waterloo, and our friend Michael had just asked a question. Just to give you, Barry, a little perspective on time, we've got about 5 or 7 minutes, because I would like to get to the question of the importance of the battle or the historic importance of the battle. So if you could answer Michael, and then let's get to that topic, Barry.
Okay, so the answer Michael's question, which is Michael still on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. Well, Michael brought up a great point, which is this. The British like to think that they won the Battle of Waterloo, despite the fact that they had unreliable, in their opinion, unreliable Dutch and Belgian allies. Much of which is true, but not completely. I mean, there were some very good German, Dutch, Belgian units, some of which even had served with Napoleon when those countries had been part of the Napoleonic Empire within the last decade. And were not very happy to fight the French. They liked the French better than they liked the British. But that said, either way, the British didn't really win that battle. They held their position barely throughout the battle, with Napoleon fighting with one hand tied behind his back, that in almost really a hand and a half, because he had detached the day before 33,000 troops under Marshal Grouchy, somewhat to the east, to pursue the Prussians and keep them from joining Wellington during the battle. And Grouchy, who was an incompetent commander, as it proved, was completely inept at doing that and unable to keep the Prussians out. In fact, he never got within 6 miles of the rear guard for most of his pursuit. So the Prussians got in the battle, and Napoleon was missing those 33,000 troops the entire day. Worse, Lobau's corps, which was, I think, another 15,000 or so, was facing the Prussians throughout the entire day. So basically, his forces facing Wellington were missing a big chunk of his army. And he was, after the first few hours, he was even outnumbered. His initial attack by Delon's corps was defeated by the British cavalry. And from then on, he was fighting with a numerical disadvantage in infantry. He had lots of cavalry, but not enough infantry. So at the end of the day, Napoleon has been beating his head against this position all day. And finally, he throws the dice one last time. I'm making this very brief because of, you know, time constraints. Because the battle, you know, is very involved, lots of different phases. But by the end of the day, the last reserves he had were his Imperial Guard. And not even all those. Some of those were committed already to fight the Prussians on his right flank. But what he had was what was called the Middle Guard and some of the Young Guard, and some a battalion of the Old Guard that was still not committed against the Prussians. And those assaulted Wellington's position in the center. And they marched up the hill, and nobody in the history of the corps had ever defeated the Old Guard or the Imperial Guard. Once they were committed, it generally meant that victory was in sight. But this time, they were faced by very well-coordinated musketry at point-blank range by very good British units, particularly the Guards. And they were shot in flank by other British units that had been defending Hougoumont, which was a chateau on Wellington's right. And they were caught in what we call in the modern-day army an L-shaped ambush, essentially, being shot at from two sides. And the Guard was stopped and then repulsed. They retreated back down the hill. And the British, if you listen to a British version of Waterloo, that is what won the battle. But that's not true. And this is what Michael is referring to, Silvio. At about that same time, the Prussians brought up a cavalry corps, and that cavalry corps under Ziethen broke through the joint between Napoleon's right facing to the south and facing east, but on a north-south axis. They broke the joint between that wing and his main line facing north. So basically at the L shape, they broke the joint between the two wings. And cavalry suddenly were swarming into the rear of Napoleon's advancing line that was trying to push Wellington one last time off the road, off his position, off the ridge. And so at that point, the French army broke, and there was no stopping them. So you could say the Prussians really won that battle by finally breaking through the French line and, in fact, keeping the French tied down at Plassenois throughout the entire battle.
Interesting. Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us with your question. And thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I just wish we had more time.
Yeah, I know. It's unfortunate. Sometimes we cannot get everything done at one time. We've got a couple of minutes, Barry, and I guess one quick reaction of mine is that listening to you and listening to the callers, there's no question that Napoleon is the character here. If this was a book, he'd be the lead character. You know, it's just we keep going back to Napoleon and Napoleon. I guess that's fascinating. I kind of knew that, but the more I listen to you tonight and I hear some of the questions, it's obvious that Napoleon was the character. But if you were telling a class of, let's say, a history class in high school, seventh grade class, doing their first class of world history, in a couple of minutes, how would you explain to them the importance of this battle? What did this battle do? What did it change? And why is it important 200 years later, Barry?
Well, first, it's important at its time because defeating Napoleon put an end to about 20 years of war. Most of which have been started by or exacerbated by his ambition. Napoleon was trying to unify Europe, and he was defeated, and what resulted in what was called the Conference of Vienna, where all the victorious powers were meeting. In fact, during the time of Waterloo, they had met, because they had met after he had first abdicated in 1814. But they basically divide up modern Europe, and when I say modern Europe, I mean Europe as it would look until World War One. You know, the monarchies of World War One, which we talked about earlier in the year in our series on World War One. That geography, that map of Europe, was drawn up at the Conference of Vienna, which took place after the Napoleonic Wars. And that's, up until today, that was about the most peaceful period in European history that resulted after this, where Europe, for the most part, fought no wars of any consequence on the European continent. And that was something that Europe had not seen since probably the fall of the Roman Empire. So that's the first thing, and that was a positive thing that came out of, you know, of Wellington and Blücher's victory at Waterloo. The reverse, though, is what could have happened if Napoleon had won? Well, Napoleon, often as people will say, well, it didn't matter because there were still the Russians and the Austrians, you know, waiting on the Rhine River near Strasbourg. And even if he'd won, he would have had to defeat them. Well, that's probably true, but he probably would have defeated them. If he had won at Waterloo and taken Brussels, that whole Anglo-Belgian kingdom would have collapsed, and he would have been able to turn it into a client kingdom probably overnight. They probably would have made peace with him immediately. And Belgium, which had been part of France up until his defeat a year before, would have reverted back, and he would have gained about 30,000 troops that way. And with reinforced by success, I think he would have been able to march around the flank and down around the rear of the troops on the Rhine and either defeated them or forced them to withdraw.
The big victory was England, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the victory was to remove the nearest threat and then force the others to back off. And yeah. England was by far the most implacable enemy, in that England had really financed all the rest of the powers, you know, throughout those wars. And England was a very rich country. So the positive was that, yeah, his fall brought peace and stability, but the negative was that it prevented Europe from being united until this day. If you think of Europe today, they're still struggling to unify.
Right.
Napoleon gave a chance to unify under one power, albeit French.
Right. Well, Barry, I want to thank you so much for this program. It's absolutely marvelous. And I wish we had more time, but we don't. I also want to thank the callers and just great information. And I'm directing everyone to the article that you wrote. We have a link to it on the show information. You go into a lot of detail there as well. And, of course, your blog, we also have a link to that as well. So just again, thank you so much for your contributions tonight. Next week, we'll get back to the regular stuff, current events. But this was a great treat to hear your analysis of the Battle of Waterloo. I learned a great deal tonight, and I'm grateful to you for that.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I hope your listeners take a little bit of time, and if they're interested in the subject, take a look at those articles. I spent a lot of time on them, and I bring about a lot of theories. I explode a lot of rumors and theories about the Waterloo that have made it into the popular history that just aren't true. And if you read my articles, you'll see what I think is a better take on the battle.
Very good, Barry. Thank you so much, and good night.
Have a good evening.
Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, a military blogger, military historian, and tonight our topic was the Battle of Waterloo, and man, a lot of information, and we're grateful to Barry for that. Thank you so much for listening. This is Silvio Cantu in Dallas.